This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 70th anniversary of VE Day this week with one of the most compelling prisoner of war stories we've heard on Hometown Heroes.
Let's get right back to it with Glenn Schmidt, who was a prisoner of war during World War II. You heard about the events leading up to his capture, but I glossed over, Glenn, another close call, and you talked freely about some of the other men you served with. It's clear in the tone of your voice how much respect and esteem and admiration you have for those men and how powerful that still is today. And nothing grabs you more than knowing that someone else paid the price that you could have easily paid. I understand there was another moment where your position was under attack and where you actually got up to take a position. And if you had, if you'd been allowed to do so, you wouldn't be sitting with me here today. Tell me about that.
I do not recall the name of the village that we were in, and I don't know if I've ever made mention of this to anyone, but we were going through this village, and as soon as I made a turn in the town, I looked straight ahead, and at the end of the street was a German artillery piece with a couple of soldiers behind it. And I ducked into into an office area, ducked in away from a field of fire. And just that instant, they fired, and fellas in front of me were completely obliterated.
I can't imagine what that does to you. That the position, was it a tank that you were in, where they said, "Come to the top, Smitty. Go to the top," and you started to go, and Smith said, "No, I'll go instead."
This particular incident was in the same German pillbox that I was captured in.
Mm-hmm.
That particular day, the platoon sergeant, his name was Al Cahoon, said, "Smitty, go on up to the turret and see what's going on, to find out what's taking place." Well, it's like a well that went up to the top of the pillbox with rebar in it to step on, like steps.
And a gun turret at the top.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My friend Bill Smith, he went ahead of me, and he said, "Smitty, you're doing a good job taking care of the wounded." And which I was, doing the best of my ability, because we only had one medic with us. His name was Ralph J. Mashad from Northern Maine. And he was the only medic to take care of all the wounded that were coming back in or being brought back in, carried back in. While I was sitting behind Captain Corson, our company commander, Bill Smith told me, you stay here, I'll go on up." As Bill Smith went, our company commander then decided to go on up behind him. And he said, "I'm going to take a look around too." At that time, an 88 that was situated some yards, 100 yards ahead of us, was zeroed in on that turret, probably with an officer, somebody with the binoculars, to see if there was any movement. As soon as Bill Smith had looked out one of the openings of this turret, they fired. Bill Smith came down in just pieces, and that's when our company commander was severely wounded.
And that would have been you.
It would have been me. I wouldn't be talking to you today.
And that really gets your attention,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes. I've since tried to reach the family. Bill Smith's brother was totally deaf, could not hear. I talked to his wife some years ago, and that's about the only communication I have had with him.
And one thing that really strikes me, and I know it's clear with the life that you've lived since, so many veterans who I talked to who had an experience like that where they realized so clearly it could have been them, they are so motivated to live a life that honors that life that did pay that price. And is it fair to say that that's an approach you've taken?
I would say so. It's, you know, you don't often think about those things, but I'm glad for the fact that I have remained alive in a situation that I could give my testimony to others.
And you are certainly a survivor. We're going to hear more about that. But I know I'm skipping around time-wise here. Another thing that strikes me in hearing what I have of your story as a very powerful moment for you, just before this all unfolded, just before you were nearly killed with that bullet and then eventually captured, you got a letter from home.
Yes, sir.
What did your dad have to say to you that really hit home for you?
It's the only letter I can remember in all the time that I was over there that I had received from my father. And my father was not a writer of letters, I can tell you that. He wrote, a portion of the 91st Psalm, the 7th verse, where it says, 1,000 shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, and it shall not come nigh thee. After I read that letter and we were told to go out on this patrol, I asked the fellows to take off their helmets and bow in a moment of a prayer, which we did. I'm so thankful I did at that time because, like I say, or have told, there are some that did not survive.
And obviously that's something that stuck with you and something that really proved true. As they died all around you, you found a way to survive. We talked about your capture, and I know the journey to the prisoner of war camp is a story in itself. I want to get to the conditions inside the camp, but just getting to it was pretty harrowing. Not only are you being marched and taken on trains and transported this way or that, at one point you had a very real fear that you could be killed by your own troops who were firing at your position.
The night we were captured, we were taken to a little town by the name of Buell, B-U-H-L, and lined up in the street. And our artillery was zeroing in on this little village. The church was on fire, and they're trying to set more buildings on fire with white phosphorus shells. And at that time, in two groups, we were separated maybe 20 feet, and an artillery shell came in, landed on that street between our two groups, ricocheted through the fence, and did not explode. Now, that's a miracle in itself.
And it wouldn't have bothered the Germans a whole lot if you guys had been killed.
No, sir.
Obviously, they were leaving you out there for that possibility.
It could have been.
So again, somebody's looking out for you. Then you get to the prisoner of war camp. And you had gone in, you described carrying around your BAR equipment, and you were strapping 145 pounds. Did you realize after you'd been captured that the starvation was going to set in? Did you realize that you would be so malnourished and fed so little?
Not at all. We had no idea. The Germans told us that the war was over for us and we could relax. But the day we walked into camp, there were approximately 100 of us, and I was up in front of the group because I had been in front of the group for some time without going into that part of the story. A German guard standing at the gate in good English says, "You will live from 5 to 7 months on what you get to eat here." Those weren't very encouraging words. The fellows behind us wanted to know what he said, and none of us would repeat it. But it proved to be quite true.
Well, and of course, at this point, nobody knows when the war is going to end. It's an uncertain future. You don't know what tomorrow is going to hold, but
that's true.
Is certainly unnerving. And then, as you said, it was proven true with the diet that you got. You hear about prisoner of war camps and aid parcels that show up. That didn't happen very often at Stalag 9B, did it?
No, sir. No. In the morning, they brought up, fellas went down to what we called a kitchen and brought up a barrel of ersatz coffee. It was just maybe a little chicory in it. We don't know. It had some color, and that's about it. Most of the fellas just washed in it. I drank it because I wanted something warm inside of me because there's still snow on the ground all over. We were up on a mountaintop southeast of Frankfurt, about 30 miles.
And as far as food, not much of anything. Some bread with a lot of sawdust in it, probably?
Yes. In the evening, a loaf of bread was handed to us to be divided between not less than six, mostly 10 to 12 fellas. I used my pocket knife. It was to be divided among six men or whatever. A group was chosen up, and I handed my pocket knife to him, and he cut it up as evenly as he could. The fellow who cut the bread got the last piece.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he cut it as close as he could.
I do understand. I know this was absolutely horrific. And when you were finally liberated, you're only 92 pounds. So people can do the math and see what kind of starvation was going on there. But at one point, when you actually did get some food, you got a little taste of home. You actually had fruit bars from the valley?
Yes, sir. The K rations had a fruit bar for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The breakfast unit had a fruit bar. I guess it was peaches, apricots, raisins, figs, and may have been some other fruit, probably apricots, in a bar, maybe 3.5-4 inches long. And fellas would just give that away, trade it off, which I really like it coming from San Joaquin Valley. It was good for me because it began to clean me out. The reason being is that the luncheon menu had a had a chunk of cheese in it. That cheese was pretty good, too. But if you ate the D-bar, we called the D-bar, it was a chocolate bar, in the evening, you had to have the fruit bar in the morning to clean you out.
I think everybody knows where you're going. And I have a surprise guest joining us on the line from Wichita, Kansas, is Dr. Bill Pascal, who, like Glenn, was a prisoner at Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany, during World War II. And these two did not know each other at the time, at least not by name. But Dr. Pascal, can you tell us quickly how you became aware of this gentleman named Glenn Schmidt and the powerful first impression that he made on you?
Yes, I sure can, Paul. Glenn is actually a lifesaver. We were in the prison camp Bad Orb, Germany, and things were pretty grim. We'd witnessed some brutality to our man of confidence. We had been lined up in the yard with the guards facing us with machine guns. The food was almost non-existent. Recreation facilities were nothing. The building that we were in was a thin board roof and upper part of the walls. When it snowed outside, it snowed inside. And actually, a lot of the men in this building that I was in, there were 3,000 Americans, but there were 300 men in the barracks I was in. A lot of the men gave up hope, and they thought that it was a question of not when they would get liberated, but how long they could survive in this environment. Some of these men turned their face to the wall and didn't communicate with the rest of us. They kind of daydreamed the day away, and sure enough, they became the first to pass away or die. One night, there was a big, strong voice came out and said, "I shall recite to you the 23rd Psalm," and this voice began to do that. There was quite a few, non-believers in the crowd. There was quite a few boos and catcalls, but this strong voice recited the 23rd Psalm and some other things from the New Testament, sang some songs, and it was almost like a miracle that barracks became very, very quiet and attentive. You could hear a pin drop. This voice kept this up night after night. And so the lights were out, 300 men crowded there, couldn't put a face to it. During the daytime, I spent 3 or 4 days, I wandered through the crowd of people that were in our barracks, talking to different people, and I would excuse myself and go on and talk to another person. Finally, I located the owner of that voice, and that was Glenn Smith of the 42nd Infantry Division.
And he's sitting here right now, and he just heard everything you said. And he's got a little water in his eyes after hearing it. Dr. Pascal, thank you. I know Glenn wouldn't have told us that story himself. Thank you for coming on and sharing it. Thank you for serving our country. And if you're up for it, I'd like to have you on for a full program one of these days.
Okay, that's fine. You bet.
Anything? God bless you, Bill.
You bet, Glenn.
So good to hear from you.
Yes.
I know you two share a very special bond. And,
yes, we do.
And I'll be back in touch with you, Dr. Pascal. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, you bet.
All right, that's Bill Pascal from Wichita, Kansas, surprising Glenn Schmidt with that little story. And I know for you at home, that probably grabbed your attention the way it grabbed mine. Glenn, I think the question everyone asks is, why? What possessed you to take that kind of role and try to encourage all these other men? Why? What made that possible, and why did you do that?
Well, it was a period of desperation for us all. And I felt that if we didn't group together and try to hold the line ourselves, we would see the end like many others did. I'm just grateful to my Heavenly Father for giving me the inspiration to do that. Yeah, it's nothing in me. It's God alone.
And when the Germans took you captive, you left your helmet behind in that pillbox, but they let you take three things?
Yes, my pocket knife, my wedding ring, and my New Testament. And that New Testament went around our barracks from every day. We had Bible study, we had prayer time together, and I'm so thankful for it.
And obviously, from what we heard from Dr. Pascal, there are a lot of other POWs who are pretty thankful for it too. Now, you're slowly starving to death. You have no idea when liberation is going to come. When it did come, how great of a day was that for you? And did you have enough energy to even enjoy it?
At that time, I was so weak, I had to crawl across the floor, pull myself up either against the wall or against a pillar supporting the building in order to stand. And it was very difficult to walk at that time.
When that happened, did that feel like an answer to prayer for you?
Yes, it did. The day before, which was Easter Sunday, 1st of April, 1945, some of us went outside. I asked the fellows if they'd like to go out for a little time of prayer, which we did. We heard machine gun fire coming up out of the valley below us, and we went back into the barracks that night, not knowing that all the guards were going to either leave or surrender the next day.
Was it almost too good to be true?
Yes, it was. It was a day of not only liberation, but a day of elation.
I've heard so many POWs say that once they actually got real food, they ate a little too much and got sick. How about you? Did you have more common sense?
I had more common sense. I really didn't realize I did. It took me all day, once we got some food, to eat two cans of sea rations. All day to eat the two cans. One can had either ham and eggs or spaghetti and meatballs or something like that. The other can had two dry biscuits, some cigarettes, toilet paper, chewing gum, a bit of candy, and some instant coffee or orange drink.
And to a lot of people, that sounds pretty mundane. But to you, that was a feast for a king, right?
Amen. Absolutely. You bet.
You know, we're running out of time, and I know there's so much we haven't covered. But I mentioned earlier that you were an Army veteran of World War II, but also an Air Force veteran. Glenn went back into the Air Force, retired as a major. And in the early 1960s, you were stationed in Strasbourg. If people have been listening closely, they know that's very close to that pillbox where you had been captured and where you left your helmet.
One Sunday afternoon, I took my whole family through an area that I had fought through. We couldn't naturally cover it all, but we went back to the little town of Hatton where I was captured.
And you had your two sons with you?
Yes, I did.
And they wanted to go in the pillbox?
There were signs all around in English, French, and German to keep out because of the high impact of shells in that area.
But they went in anyway.
They went down inside, obey all your commands anyways. One came out with a grenade. My youngest came out with a grenade, and my oldest came out with my steel helmet. Had been there for 17 years.
Could you believe it?
No, sir. At the first, I couldn't. But when I examined it real closely, it had the PFC stripe painted off-center and had my name in white on the inside, my last name.
And those two bullet holes were a pretty good sign, too.
Definitely. Well, naturally, I recognized that immediately.
And I know that sounds hard to believe, that 17 years later it would still be there, but it was. Glenn has the helmet to prove it, and if you'd like to see a picture of that,
just visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page.
It's just an incredible story that Glenn has shared. We've only gotten some pieces of it, but I think you can tell what an incredible life that he's led, and he's still leading. Glenn, in closing here, is there one thing that your experience, so many close calls, seeing so many other men pay the ultimate price for our freedom and come so close to doing that yourself with everything you've been through, what's the most important thing that those experiences have taught you?
The motto of the ex-prisoners of war is freedom is not free. I see that even today. There are men giving their lives for their country. We always have. Throughout, when men are called upon, men and women today are called upon to sacrifice for their country, they seem to do it willingly. That price that they pay is the ultimate price that anyone could pay with their life. I am deeply gratified for my God and my country.
And I don't blame you. And we are very thankful that not just that you served our country, that you were willing to pay that price if need be, but that you're willing to share with us about it today. Thank you so much, Glenn, and God bless you.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for having me on.
He just said it, but if you're a regular listener, you know it's the last thing I say every week. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. Let the 70th anniversary of VE Day be another reminder to you that freedom is not free.